years, because we've seen a lot of different issues come on the scene that are important to younger citizens that maybe they feel haven't been addressed adequately by the current administration or even the previous one. And so there's been some motivation to try and get involved and influence election outcomes so they can influence policy in different directions.
According to the data firm Target Smart, more than 40% of the nearly 5 million voters who are voting for the first time are young people under 30 years old. Reporting from Miami, Ronnie Curvello.
French President Macron announced a full national lockdown for at least 1 month. The reason? Positive coronavirus cases doubled or even tripled the last 4 weeks, and the number of fatalities due to the COVID increased drastically. Local lockdowns and curfews are definitely not sufficient to repel the virus. A second lockdown in 6 months' time, many shopkeepers fear for a national bankruptcy.
We will see. For now, we are forced to close. As Macron said, we close the restaurants.
The consequences are dramatic for everyone. We in this fast food restaurant have to sell quickly the meat and the vegetables. Right now, 70 kilos of meat have to be thrown away, vegetables as well. The consequences are even more dramatic for precarious workers.
The first consequence is that we have to close one of our three agencies. Since we're not a basic necessity business, we are obliged to close this evening because it's forbidden for us to organize meetings or general assemblies with co-owners. So starting from tonight, we will suffer a 100% loss of activity.
Bars and restaurants are the most obvious victims of the lockdown, but other sectors are not spared. France is a big airplane manufacturer. Airbus is a European company, but France has an important part in it. The aviation sector is already very affected and will be even more with the second lockdown. Over the year 2020, due to the coronavirus crisis, there will be an estimated minus 10% economic growth. The unemployment rate will probably go over 10% before the end of the year.
Some employees will certainly be fired. They will get partial unemployment benefits because we will not be able to pay their payroll taxes.
We have already been closed for 1 month in March. It has a huge impact on the company's financial health with partial unemployment. I have reduced the number of my employees. I had to fire one.
Macron said that almost 10,000 coronavirus patients will be in intensive care by mid-November. Meanwhile, France has less than 6,000 hospital beds available.
The French government hopes that the full lockdown on the entire territory will push back the coronavirus, but the impact on the economy will definitely be catastrophic. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Thousands of Yemenis gathered in the capital Sana'a and 13 other cities across the country to celebrate the Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary. This year's celebration comes amid the Islamophobic wave raging after reprinting of the insulting cartoons of Islam's Prophet Muhammad in France.
We came here today to renew our loyalty and love to Prophet Muhammad in the time of hypocrisy and fake beliefs.
Today's gathering comes not only to celebrate the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad, but also as a response to the French president and his insults against our Prophet.
Rage is growing across the Muslim world at the French president Emmanuel Macron and his attacks on Islam and the Prophet Muhammad, leading to calls for boycotts of the French products. Yemenis gathering here say Islam is the religion of peace and its prophet is a symbol of peace, but some people are seeking to insult him under the pretext of the freedom of speech.
It is known that France is a country devoid of values and in which insults are made against God, the messenger Muhammad, Jesus, Moses and all prophets.
Yemeni ceremony included various cultural and religious events like reciting verses from Holy Quran.
Despite all the hardships people are facing in the country, Yemenis proved that insulting the Prophet of Islam is a red line which cannot be crossed. Abdulatif al-Washali, Sana'a.
The The suspected terrorist attack happened at the Notre Dame Church in the city of Nice. A knife-wielding attacker beheaded a woman and killed two other people. Police say several others have been injured. The assailant was shot by police and hospitalized.
We just learned from the televisions that our church warden has been killed. I'm so shocked. I still imagine him. I still see him walking, lighting the candles.
Police, armed with automatic weapons, put up a security cordon around the church located on Nice's main shopping thoroughfare. Ambulances and fire service vehicles arrived at the scene to help. The city's mayor, Christian Estrosi, visited the scene.
I have to say that Nice, like France, but maybe more than other places in France, today is paying too heavy a price.
The response from the country's Muslim leaders was immediate. The French Council of the Muslim Faith condemned the attack and expressed solidarity with the victims and their families. Nice was the target of one of France's deadliest attacks in recent years, when a 31-year-old Tunisian drove a truck into crowds celebrating Bastille Day on July 14, 2016, killing 86 people. Thursday's attack comes less than 2 weeks since the beheading by a Chechen extremist of Samuel Paty, a teacher who showed the offensive Charlie Hebdo cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad to his pupils in a school near Paris. That was followed by a knife attack on two Muslim women near the Eiffel Tower last week. French President Emmanuel Macron is facing mounting criticism from the Muslim world for refusing to condemn the Charlie Hebdo cartoons and for cracking down on what he calls radical Islam. His stance has infuriated Muslims around the world and led to calls for a boycott of French products. Iran, Turkey, and several other Muslim-majority countries have been the scene of angry protests against the French government over the past week or so. Iranian leaders warned Mr. Macron's approach would only fuel extremism. The Turkish president, whose own cartoon has also appeared in Charlie Hebdo in recent days, has also been vocal.
They literally want to relaunch the Crusades. Since the Crusades, the seeds of evil and hatred have started falling on these lands, and that's when peace was disrupted.
France is home to nearly 6 million Muslims. The Samuel Paty murder had already heightened tensions in the country, and the French president's defense of the Charlie Hebdo magazine in the name of freedom of speech seems to have only added fuel to the fire.
In late March, the United States federal government passed the CARES Emergency Fiscal Aid Package. Back then, almost nobody would have guessed that it would be the only direct economic stimulus to households until after November's elections, or possibly ever. Months of negotiations have proven fruitless. Congress just adjourned for next week's elections, crushing hopes for the widely expected and long-awaited but desperately needed second stimulus package. New polls showed that Republicans and Democrats are being blamed in almost equal measure, reflecting how the elite of both parties seemingly intervened negatively whenever a second stimulus package appeared close.
Both sides are to blame. You got Trump saying he's approved it, and then he's saying Nancy Pelosi is not accepting that stimulus package. And on her side, she's saying it's not what the American people want, and she's not going to let us down by just, you know, signing off on a package that's just not good for the American people. So I would say Congress and all, presidents, on the senators and House of Republicans, all.
The economic catastrophe wrought by the implementation and handling of the Great Lockdown in the United States has increased the poverty rate nearly 20% since May. Almost a million unemployment claims are still being filed every single week. There is no end in sight to unprecedented demand at food banks. The list goes on and on.
Yeah, they need to have one. There's a lot of people who aren't working, and unemployment doesn't really cover the cost to live. It's expensive to live in Chicago. I live in San Francisco, and it's expensive to live there. There's a lot of people who are unemployed, so I really feel that the stimulus is needed.
The expected second wave of coronavirus has arrived, and many areas of the United States are resorting to the same tactic, economically devastating lockdowns. For many, the math is simple. More lockdowns plus no governmental assistance equals more economic devastation. The second stimulus failure by the U.S. elites could fuel always high abstention and a turn to third parties in next week's elections. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense. The very sensitive and outstanding leadership and command of Imam Khomeini.
The second point is that the Sacred Defense was one of the most rational events for the Iranian nation. Some people accuse the people active in the Sacred Defense of lacking insight, citing some mistake made here and there by a group of people. This is not the case in any way. The actions done during the Sacred Defense were intelligent and rational from start to finish. In the beginning, the speeches made by Imam or others indicated the right decision to enter into that arena. After that, we witnessed cooperation between the Guards Corps and the Army. Notice that this is a very important matter. In those days, the army was a traditional and well-established organization in the country, and the Guards Corps was a young newcomer in the revolutionary arena. It was necessary for them to work together, something that was not easy, but it happened.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, when Bani Sadr fled the country, this happened in a better and more complete manner. But it existed before that too. I myself witnessed in Abu Dhar base that the late Shahid Pichak was the second in command to the army commander of that base whose name I do not remember. A Guards Corps commander was the second in command to an army commander. They would work and live together. In the western part of the country, the Abu Dhar base was a sensitive place as they were in charge of a large section of the war. When the new development took place, Bani Sadr fleeing the country and the Imam undertaking the responsibility to command the armed forces, the cooperation between the army and the Guards Corps became even clearer.
Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. More unrest in the United States as yet another black man has been killed by police in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. 14 shots were fired by police at 27-year-old Walter Wallace, who had a knife. Now, those protesting are angry at police for not handling the situation in a different way and say if he had been a white man, he would have never been fatally wounded. Well, stay with us as we take a look at what has been sweeping the United States, especially this year. On this debate, we're going to start off in Washington, D.C., joined by Colin Cabell. Well, fill us in on this latest situation, this time out of Philadelphia, and also curfews are in effect.
That's right. This involves the case of Walter Wallace, a young man who has a history of mental health issues, and his parents say that when they called the police, or 911 rather, for an emergency responder, they were hoping that a health official would show up. They were calling because he had an episode, a mental health episode, which was not unfamiliar to him, but when it did happen from time to time, it could become violent. And they were hoping that the hospital, a representative from the hospital, first responder, someone who could de-escalate the situation would show up. Well, the police showed up, and that often happens when you call 911 in the U.S. Well, instead of really trying to control the situation where they could have a peaceful outcome, they told him to lower a knife that he had been holding. After they told him several times to lose the knife, they opened fire on him, killing him, and that was the end of Walter Wallace there, who died in a hail of police gunfire. He was shot in the chest and in the shoulder, and he was brought to the hospital where he later died. Now, people are saying that that did not have to happen, and that's why you hear protesters talking about defunding the police. It doesn't mean they want to get rid of police. What defund the police means is taking funds, money, that is usually just given to police departments, but also giving it to other departments so that on specific calls, these other departments can answer those calls so they don't end up in fatal shootings like what happened with Mr. Wallace.
All right. Thank you so much, Colin, for that. We're going to cross over now to St. Petersburg, Florida, where we're joined by African People's Socialist Party member Omali Yeshetela. Thank you so much for being with us. Omali, you've heard our correspondent in Washington talking about the overall situation. And I mean, we have heard this so many times, time and time again. And many people are asking, why 14 shots? Why would, first of all, police have to open fire 7 rounds each police officer for somebody who was carrying a knife but seemed, from the video I saw, not lunging at them?
Yes, thank you very much. And I think we have been hearing this over and over and over again. And it seems to me we've been hearing it enough to recognize that this cannot be an accident. This is not just some careless policing or the absence of body cameras or some kind of insensitivity on the part of the police department. Every police department in this country suffers from this problem. And it is because what the police here are dealing with is our community, African people, in the same way that an occupying army, a military force in a foreign territory would treat people. It's you hear these kinds of accidents, like killing this brother, shooting him so many times. You hear this kind of thing happening with the U.S. in Afghanistan, with the U.S. in other foreign territories where they are occupying. They know they're a hostile occupying a military force, and that's what they represent in the African community, with Africans in particular, but also with indigenous people in this country, because you have to remember that the United States is a settler colony. It's a settler colony where Europeans came here just like they went to Israel, just like they went to Australia and other places like that, and took the land and enslaved the people. In this instance, of course, they brought Africans to this country where they enslaved us. And we've been living under settler colonial domination. It's a colonizer country. And what we saw happen with this brother Wallace is a consequence of any time you have settler colonialism, the proclivity to kill, kill, kill.
Well, let me welcome my next guest to the program out of Minneapolis, Minnesota, Jack Rice, lawyer and media activist. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Jack, what I was saying to Omali, I mean, we've repeated this so many times and hearing about this. And in this year, 2020, we've witnessed many people protesting and highlighting police violence, especially against African Americans. Yet we continue to witness more African Americans being killed by police still on a regular basis. So what's key here? What is missing? What has to be done? Because, as I said, we've seen many demonstrations, and the police are under a lot more scrutiny, but still we're seeing the same result.
Well, I've been listening to your previous guests, and I think first what I would say is we may be witnessing more attacks on African Americans, but the reason we're witnessing is because people have cell phones. If you look back historically, you can take a look at what's going on in the United States, where African Americans, indigenous people, Native Americans, and others have been targeted again and again and again. The numbers are astounding right now, only because you can't deny them. What we have seen in the past is the United States and frequently police departments have simply denied these issues, and then they go away. But what we know now is that while there are numbers and they continue to be as astounding as they are, we're still seeing a very small number of police officers who are actually being prosecuted. Even further, the number of police officers who are actually being convicted is even less. And I'm coming to you as a former prosecutor, a criminal defense lawyer. I walk into courtrooms almost every single day. And so I watch how these issues play themselves out. A lot of my clients are people of color. And as a result of that, I see those issues, and I've seen it in courtrooms. I've seen it from juries. I've seen it from judges. I've seen it from prosecutors. And I've absolutely seen it from police officers.
Go ahead, Omali.
I think that's a really important statement that he just made, that it has been happening all along, and it's not that people didn't know about it. I'm old enough to remember the U.S. engagement in Vietnam and how one of the problems the United States had was that media were there on the ground, and they were recording the crimes that the United States was committing against the people of Vietnam. And the truth is that the colonizer wants to maintain the status quo, wants to maintain the colonized, but doesn't want to see it, doesn't want to see the consequences of what he's voting for, what he's supporting, etc. And that's what's happening here in this country, in the United States. as the gentleman mentioned, this has been happening a long time, but now you got cell phones and you can look at it and you can see a cop with his knee on the neck killing an African man after holding him, pressing him for more than 8 minutes. And normally, traditionally, what happens when we say that the police have done this, the police have done that, and our community's response from the white community is, well, you must have done something. They wouldn't just do that to you. You must have done something. And that's been the tradition up until recently, and now it's something that cannot be easily dismissed, and I don't think it'll ever go away, despite all of the kinds of things that different social media organizations are trying to do to keep people from seeing what's going on, or to frame what people are seeing as some kind of intervention from some foreign country.
Well, Omali, you said that you feel that it's not going to go away because it's being seen. But being seen, is it enough? Will there be changes that will be implemented? I mean, if we look at, we're in almost the end of 2020, and we have been seeing this, especially highlighted this year. Do you think that major changes have taken place? I mean, if we go back to 50 years ago, we've been seeing African Americans and demonstrating against racism and against police violence. So being out there more, do you think that in itself is enough to bring about a change?
No, I don't. I think that if they were able to change, they'd do it. I heard leading into this story how, despite the fact that there have been so many killings, so many protests, and things like that, things still remain the same. Why? I mean, and the fact of the matter is that the protests are so serious now, they're having to talk about sending in national or federal troops and federal forces to try to keep it down. If they could not do it, they would not do it. If it were possible, the reason it's not possible is because African people live under colonial domination, and it's only this nonsense about racism, white people don't like us, or what they call systematic racism. If you get rid of that and treat what's happening to African people like how we treat it happening to anybody else in the world, it's colonialism. And people will not suffer the kinds of things that's happened to them by foreign and alien power without the use of extreme violence. And there's no way they can control this community, control African people, control Mexicans, control the indigenous people whose land is stolen without extreme violence. And the police is that arm of the state that's most closely associated with the people on the ground, in the street. It's the first line of an oppressive system in defense of the oppressive system itself.
Well, Jack, your take on that, because we've seen this growing schism in the United States, and we talk about, especially, on the one hand, when we talk about demonstrations, we've seen many white Americans, young white Americans, actually even taking the lead in some of the demonstrations. On the other hand, we see this polarization of other sections of the society. Based on what Omali just said, how likely is it that this society is heading towards more violence? As he said, more and more African Americans are seeing that so many years of protests and really nothing has changed, that at the end of the day, do you think that they will feel that only violence can meet violence?
I think that it'll wax and wane, to be honest. I think that this is a slow and ongoing process. I certainly understand the frustration. I certainly do. And again, I'm in South Minneapolis. I live 9 blocks from where George Floyd was murdered in the street. So I think about what that means. And yet at the same time, I think that there are people who are starting to understand and starting to address issues. Is it enough? Absolutely not. Is it systemic in terms of how things are applied? It absolutely is. And the idea that somehow some will assume and are arguing that it's a question of history, how African Americans were treated under slavery, misses the point fundamentally, because it happens today. It happens right now. I'm not just talking about redlining and the history of redlining. I'm talking about the impact that is happening to people of color in the United States today. And this has happened this afternoon, this morning, and the reaction from those who wish to deny it. And it's that gulf, the gulf between those who don't even see it on the one side, purposely, willingly, and those who have to live with it every single day. It's the need to bridge that gulf, which takes so much time and so much effort. But I'm an optimist. I have to believe that slowly but surely, we can do more. We can be a better people. Martin Luther King was right. We can do more.
I want to just appreciate what his comrade has said. I think it's really important what he said, and he draws out the point that I want to make, that it is systemic. And this system is colonialism, and I think it's important to say it's systemic because, as you raised earlier, that you see white people who are out in demonstrations and holding up their fists and what have you, and it does show the ability on some minimal level of Africans and white people to get along together on some to some extent. That I am not disagreeing with, although I might be able to say that the material interest that and involved here doesn't mean that it's exactly what it looks like. But I do want to say that people do have that kind of ability under certain circumstances. The problem is that it's not a question of whether people like each other. It's an institutional relationship. It's called colonialism. And in colonialism, there's an oppressor nation and oppressed nation of people. And that relationship is something that is consolidated and codified. And the state itself functions as the protector of that relationship between the colonized and the colonizer. That's what the police is. The police are an arm of the state. It's an occupying military force that imposes itself on African people who are colonized in order to maintain that relationship. So I agree with him 100% that people do have a greater ability, it seems, right now to get along together. But people have to understand that what we're suffering from is not, quote unquote, just people not liking each other. It's a question of power and whether or not African people ourselves should have control over our lives so that we don't have to hope and pray that some juncture enough young white people or old white people, what have you, will think highly enough of us or on their own humanity that they'll stop killing us. We have to have the power, and to do that, we have to destroy this relationship of colonialism. And that's the domination of one people by a foreign and alien power. And that's what we have here, just as we have had in Afghanistan and other places around the world.
Well, staying with what you've just said, Omai Lee, and basically that you're dealing with a colonialist power. So given that paradigm, and if we look at other colonialist entities, they usually did not allow individuals to vote into a change or to pressure them into a change. They usually had to be under so much pressure that basically they were brought down. So what does that mean when you're looking at the United States and African Americans' relationship with the United States? What needs to be done in order to bring about that reality that you were talking about?
Well, first of all, I want to say that on November 7th and 8th, the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparation that I chair is holding in Washington, D.C., a rally on Saturday, November the 7th, under the theme, Down with Colonialism, Black Power Matters, and Black Community Control of the Police. All of these are anti-colonial demands that presupposes the democratic right of African people to have control of our own lives, independent of the United States government that historically has done what it does and to us, et cetera. So we have to be able to fight for our own power. And we've had those kinds of movements in the past that were violently crushed by the United States government. There are scores of political prisoners in this country right now. And some have been in prison for 50 years just for trying to win freedom of black people. So what has to happen is that we have to become independent of both the Democrat and Republican Party or any sector of the ruling class and forge our own way. That's the thing that we are involved in doing. That's what I do on a regular basis. So it's going to be up to African people ourselves to take power over our own lives. It's not going to be given to us. It's not going to be something that all of a sudden there's going to be some kind of epiphany. And they say, wow, we've done that, black people badly. African people ourselves are going to have to do that, and that's what we're busily engaged in doing. People should come to that Black is Back mobilization on Saturday, the November 7th. Again, under the slogan, down that black power matters, down with colonialism. Down with colonialism and black community control of the police. And that's going to be in Washington, D.C. Okay. And we're going to have that rally and march on the White House. And then right across the street from the White House, we're going to have another rally and a conference on the following day.
Okay. All right. Well, Jack, your take, you just heard O'Malley basically saying it's not going to make a difference. We're dealing with Democrats or we're dealing with Republicans. And we're just a few days out from the election. And there's been a lot of debate and controversy, and especially dealing with the black vote. Does it make a difference if a Democrat is in the White House or if a Republican is in the White House as far as that reality for black Americans, especially when we're talking about police violence?
I think it can in this sense, and it's complicated. If you think about the makeup of the Supreme Court right now, we have now seen a 6-3 split, essentially conservative. And you have to understand, over the last 25 or 30 years, you've seen the Supreme Court continue to swing right anyway. So to call 6 of them conservatives and only 3 liberals, if you look at the numbers, it frankly doesn't reflect that. It's probably even further to the right than that. And yet, a poor analogy, but an analogy nevertheless, is what we saw with gay marriage. One of the issues that happened with gay marriage was it only was accepted by the Supreme Court and acceptable by the Supreme Court once a vast majority of people within the country itself said, we must have this. And so to say that they don't reflect society, I think it ignores the reality that political pressure can have on the system itself.
Okay.
I think frequently it's the shift, it's the change in society that drives the political powers to move. It's not the other way around.
Amani, your take about this, there are some that are talking about possible violence even after the election. We have seen more and more militia groups and even black militia groups taking to the streets, heavily armed. What do you think? How likely is that to happen, that this polarization continues and actually clashes, actually violent clashes taking place?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that there are black people, Africans, who are gay too. And so to say there's gay rights and somehow is some kind of astounding development. But what about the Africans who are prosecuted, persecuted, whatever their sexual preferences or orientation happens to be? Being black is not something that's eradicated because they say they're gay rights. And gay rights is something that they can give and supposed to be for everybody, but it's obviously not for everybody. It applies to white people because black people don't have any rights, whether they're heterosexual, homosexual, asexual, or anything else like that. That's one thing. And in terms of, I think there's a great possibility of violence in this country. The president himself is suggesting the need for that if he's not elected. And we're seeing from all of these security organizations of the U.S. government predicting the likelihood of violence. The FBI has established a command post in virtually every state in this country, certainly where there are Africans and white people living in the same place. So they are talking about violence and the possibility of violence. And so that's a great possibility. And I think the issue for us is that there's violence that our people are afflicted by all the time. And if you mentioned black militia groups, I haven't seen black militia groups that have come out, like Kyle Rittenhouse, who right close to where the attorney here is from, Kyle Rittenhouse, who comes out as a 16, 17-year-old white kid, shoots 3 people, kills 2 of them, and already have had several $100,000 in donations given to his defense by other white people around the country.
30 seconds, O'Malley. 30 seconds. Go ahead.
It's an extraordinarily polarized situation. America is in a state of existential crisis, and the people of must be free. African people have to be free, regardless of what party is in power, or if either party is in power. I want to thank you, Uhuru.
And I thank both of you for being with us. From the African People's Socialist Party, O'Malley Yeshatila out of St. Petersburg, Florida. Lawyer and media activist Jack Rice out of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
IB English Radio.
Unity Week. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, Salam, and welcome to the fourth part of the special series on the Unity Week that spans the 12th till 17th of the Islamic month of Rabiul Awwal to mark the anniversary of the Messenger of Mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Hope we will be true followers of him to meet him in paradise. Every year during the Unity Week, ceremonies are held in Iran and other Islamic countries with the hope that true unity would one day materialize among various Islamic communities and nations. What can help Muslims more than anything else to achieve this goal is the practice and behavior of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The history of Islam is full of the examples which show the Prophet's role in preventing from disunity among Muslim ranks. The glory and might of every nation depends on their unity and solidarity. As the great personality of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, has been the fulcrum of people's emotions and the axis of the Islamic society, he has perpetuated the beautiful concept of unity in the world. The Prophet removed the obstacles of unity such as racial discrimination, supremacy, ethnocentrism, and so on. Thus, very soon he succeeded to familiarize the people of other lands with Islam. Therefore, he established the foundations of one of the greatest and lasting civilizations in the history of mankind on the basis of faith in the one God, peace and friendship. A cursory look at the history of early years of Islam reveals that the last divine messenger put into force practical ways of unity and made Muslims a united ummah in cultural, political, and social fields. Creation of amity, elimination of grudges from hearts, conclusion of fraternal bonds among nations, encouragement of acquisition of knowledge were the ways for creation of unity in the Islamic ummah. But more important than these was to bring the people around the axis of monotheism, the Quran, and the Prophet himself. Muslims had heard this statement of the Prophet and tried not to forget it. The faithful are like a building in which a part reinforces the other part. O Muslims, do not be separate from each other. Do not turn your backs to each other. Do not be jealous of each other. Be brothers and united with each other. The migration of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, from Mecca to Medina was a turning point in the history of Islam. Upon the arrival of the Prophet in the city of Medina and settlement in the city, important developments took place in the Islamic society. The new religion had lofty programs to promote people culturally and ideologically. These programs needed coherent and systematic organization to be operational. Every tribe and group had their own customs, and there were a lot of difference among them. In such conditions, the Prophet raised the principle that Muslims are brothers of each other. This had a great and deep impact on the society of those days. He said, "Congregation is mercy and discord is punishment." After concluding a pact, he would tell different tribes to appoint representatives among themselves to supervise the implementation of the pact. Once the Prophet told one of his companions, "O Abu Ayyub, would you like me to inform you of a charity that God and his Prophet like?" He said, "Yes, Messenger of God." The Prophet continued, "Reconciliation and making peace between people and trying to reform among them." He also said, "The reward of the one who tries to reconcile among people is equal to the one who struggles in the way of God." It has been narrated that the Prophet of Islam ordered to destroy a mosque that had been built with the aim of forging rift and hostility among Muslims. This shows that even a mosque, which is apparently for the purpose of promotion and propagation of Islam, can turn into a center of causing discord and enmity among Muslims. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, in his last will, warned Muslims with the words, "O people, listen to my words. Your blood and property are haram or religiously forbidden for each other. Know that every Muslim is the brother of another Muslim." Observance of justice was one of the effective mechanisms of the Prophet for bolstering unity among Muslims. He united Muslims and obliterated irrational discriminations of the age of ignorance, that is, the era before the emergence of Islam. In view of this, he appointed the Arab Zayd ibn Haritha as the commander of the troops and the black Bilal Habashi as his special muazzin or caller to prayer. Furthermore, he glorified and respected the Iranian Salman Farsi and the Roman Sohaib. He strongly fought incorrect social privileges and replaced them with new values. What a pity that 14 centuries after his enlightening teachings, there are still people, especially among the leaders of Islamic countries, who, in words and deeds, are far distant from the Prophet, as they consider their race and nation superior to other Islamic nations. This is in stark contrast with the teachings of the Prophet and has been vehemently forbidden in the Noble Quran. The Prophet used to say that there is no difference between Arabs and non-Arabs, or white and black. The Noble Quran too highly stresses that the only factor for supremacy and nobility is taqwa, or God-weariness and piety.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.